Hadi said that despite attempts to halt Lebanon's collapse, the existing political problems are clear. International pressure, especially from France, for Beirut to draw up a government committed to reform has also failed to end the stalemate. The political impasse raises fears over Lebanon's growing poverty levels, with a number of poor likely to exceed half the population by the year 2021. The country has been without a government since August, after then-caretaker Premier Hassan Diab resigned following a deadly port blast in the capital, Beirut. For more on that story, we're first joined by our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who's with us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, with an update. Mariam, what are these complications that the Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri has mentioned?
Well, basically, Saad Hariri, I think he has reached a state where he knows that he cannot form a government on his own. And this is something he's trying to push for without getting the consent of other parliamentary blocs. And namely, he needs to get the consent of the president. And it seems the president has several remarks on the way, whether the method of forming the government, which Prime Minister Hariri is going through, or even the names of the cabinet ministers, how the portfolios are being divided. Now, it's true that most blocs have agreed that we need to get out of the sectarian system. However, in light of the current parliament, president is stressing, and other parliamentary blocs are also stressing, that the prime minister would need to get the consent of the parliamentary blocs, which are unfortunately divided based on sectarian basis. However, it seems there are other complications. Some analysts are saying that Prime Minister Saad Hariri is actually waiting for the term of U.S. President Donald Trump to end, and we have a new president in the U.S., and perhaps there would be less pressure on Lebanon, on its government, in order to isolate Hezbollah and not include them in a government, or at least not include people who are allies of Hezbollah or close to them in the current government. Now, this will all, of course, show after the new year, but for now, we don't seem to have any sign that we will be forming a government, of course.
All right, thanks a lot, Mariam. That was our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also joining us on this debate, we have activist and political commentator Laith Maarouf, who's also with us from the Lebanese capital. Okay. Mr. Maarouf, welcome to the program. Well, Saad Hariri said that despite attempts to halt Lebanon's collapse, the existing political problems are clear. What is the nature of these stumbling blocks?
The nature of the stumbling blocks for forming a government right now is specifically the demands coming from the imperial powers, which is that they don't want to have Hezbollah represented in the government, and they want to break the alliance between the Free Patriotic Movement, the party that the president only belongs to and is a founding member of. And this is unacceptable, obviously, for the country. The majority of the population are represented by these two parties, and they have a clear majority in the parliament. So to try to exclude those and pretend that you can have what is called a technocrat government, which there's no such thing. Everybody has a political affiliation in this country and on this planet in general. Everybody has a political opinion. So, and the governing of states is politics in its say. So excluding the representatives of Hezbollah or the Free Patriotic Movement means a abandonment of democracy in this country.
Let's bring in lawyer and political commentator Edward Corrigan, who's with us from London, Ontario. Mr. Corrigan, welcome to the program. Looking back at some of the grievances of the Lebanese protesters, one must think, does the Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri wield the solution, or is he himself part of the problem? Mr. Corrigan? All right, I believe we've still not established that connection. I'm going to redirect that question to our guest in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, Mr. Maarouf. Mr. Maarouf, I'm not sure if you got the question there. I'll just repeat it. Is Saad Hariri part of the solution, or is he still part of the problem?
He's definitely part of the problem, especially that he didn't learn the lesson from the previous government that he led the last time. It was, that he was chosen to be prime minister of the country, it ended up with him being kidnapped in Riyadh, strapped to a chair and slapped silly to resign on live broadcast from the capital of Saudi Arabia. And at the time, his skin was saved by Hezbollah and President Aoun. That brought him back safely to this country and allowed him to form a government at the time, given the situation. So Mr. Hariri should have learned at that time that he cannot depend on foreign powers to dictate what kind of government he has to form, and that he should have actually started cooperating with his compatriots in Lebanon and joining the Lebanese consensus in forming a government with Hezbollah and the Free Patriotic Movement.
So basically, is this just a rerun of the past, in your opinion? Has the old political show once again taken center stage with the same players and the same demands?
Definitely. See, Saudi Arabia and the United States were not happy with the outcome of that first Hariri government, national government, and we saw the demonstrations that were triggered by awful decisions made by ministers that were kind of counted on the Saudi camp within that government that Hariri had at the time. We saw the collapse of the country's economy under the pressures of American sanctions and destruction of the banking system. And now Hariri had a chance that was given to him once more by Hezbollah and the Free Patriotic Movement. And I don't know if he learned the lesson. So we're all waiting for either war to start in the region in the next 20 days before the inauguration in the United States, and or a coming of a new president that can lift some of the pressures that allow actually some decision-making to be made in Lebanon without threats of bombings.
Mr. Maruf, you just mentioned Saudi Arabia not being happy with the recent outcome in Lebanon. What was the outcome that they were looking for?
They were looking for either stripping Hezbollah of any representation in the government, which means that the government will be totally under the influence of Saudi Arabia and by extension Israel in the United States, and therefore keeping Hezbollah in a corner in Lebanon under threat, and or for a total collapse of the country with armed conflict in the streets that returned to a civil war. We saw that in the last few months with threats from the Falange of arming their militias. So we have, that's what the empire's only choices that are being put forward. Maybe with Biden, things will change.
All right, if I'm correct now, we have Mr. Edward Corrigan back with us, but he's on the line from London, Ontario. Mr. Corrigan, if you're with us, I'm going to address some of the earlier questions to you to get your perspective on the political situation right now in Lebanon. Saad Hariri, he said that despite attempts to halt Lebanon's collapse, the existing political problems are clear. Talk to us about these problems and these complications.
Well, Lebanon is a political mess at the present time. Its economy is in a terrible state. The Lebanese pound has lost 80% of its value against the U.S. dollar, and you have the complication of the big Beirut explosion, which everybody's trying to attribute blame to. And so you have a political situation and economic situation that is, poses as to disaster as you can. Now, Lebanon's politics is very unusual. It's a confessional base, so each religion has a set number of representatives in the parliament. It was originally set up in 1943 with a ratio of 6 Christians to 5 Muslims. But then in the 1989 TAF agreement, they changed it to 50-50, so 50% Christian, 50% Muslim. So you've got a breakdown of all the different groups. Now, the problem is that the Christian population has decreased significantly in Lebanon, and for sure the Muslim population is in a large majority. The Shia population is probably the largest single group in Lebanon, but only has limited power. They're equated with the same power as the Sunnis in Lebanon, and I think everybody would agree that the Shias are much larger than the Sunni population. But the problem with the current, this is like the third attempt government, and Hariri was a former premier of Lebanon when a lot of the problems occurred, and there was, you know, rampant corruption and political problems and infighting with the occasional assassination by various parties, including Hariri's father, who was the prime minister of Lebanon and a respected individual and had a lot of money, a lot of ties to Saudi Arabia. But now we have a problem where Hariri put together a list. He supposedly didn't consult with the president, Michel Aoun, and then some of the parties wanted to have veto power. They wanted to have at least, you know, three of the cabinet positions, which would give them veto over the government. And so they haven't been able to come to an agreement. And you have the parties split, but there's no agreement yet with the president or with the premier, and of course the political parties themselves. So it's been that way for months, and they seem to be unwilling to come to an agreement. And of course France is interfering, as is the United States. The United States has put sanctions against several leading Lebanese politicians because they refused to disown Hezbollah. Hezbollah is one of the largest parties in the parliament, and it represents 12 seats out of the Shia population. It's probably the best organized, most powerful political force in Lebanon itself, but of course the Americans don't like that. Of course the Israelis don't like that. But, and as a result, nothing has been resolved to date. And until they get over the petty personal differences, and they really need to reform the political system from front to bottom, and they need to actually break out of this confessional system that locks everybody into their own particular religious community and creates barriers for them to build bridges towards other communities.
Laith Maarouf, Hariri recently met with U.S. Ambassador to Lebanon, who stressed that Hezbollah must not be present in the cabinet, neither directly nor via proxy. In the past, we recall Hezbollah warned that the current U.S. administration is in fact responsible for obstructing efforts to form the government in Lebanon. What are Washington's motives?
Washington's motives is trying to isolate Hezbollah inside Lebanon, and by doing so, hoping that they can agitate enough in the government that they have control of it and Hezbollah doesn't have any influence to agitate to disarm them. And we know this is a dead end in Lebanon, and Hezbollah has already made it clear that they will not accept having no representation in the government, given that they won the most seats out of any party in this country. And, you know, although sectarianism in politics is a big problem in Lebanon, even if there's an election that is on a secular basis, there wouldn't be much change in the number of seats that each party that we have right now represented will get. And so the truth of the matter is the problem is not what is written in law, is the how things are implemented. So if a true implementation of either a sectarian electoral system or a secular one happened, Hezbollah should be represented in forming the government, because it is one of the biggest winners along with the patriotic movement of own the party there. So here is the dilemma. Democracy is allowed by the West only if it results in leadership that is in servitude to the empire. If democracy presents results with sovereignties, like in Bolivia, in Venezuela, in Syria, in Iran, in Lebanon, then those people and their democracy and their state will be targeted.
Mr. Corrigan, regionally, who benefits from uncertainty and instability in Lebanon?
Certainly the Israelis do, because they've always wanted to target Lebanon as the weakest state in the area because of its religious division. The Americans and Bush, or the Trump administration, are trying to help Israel and extend its own influence. And France is actually interfering in Lebanese politics and making pushes and demands that are inappropriate, quite frankly, but also they're trying to reestablish the old French sort of colonial dominance of the area, which of course is getting pushback from people in Lebanon. But the countries that will benefit are certainly Israel. You could argue also that maybe Saudi Arabia and some of the other Sunni countries who have supported Hariri in the past also might benefit a little bit, but out of chaos, there's I think opportunity for nobody really. Israel has constantly been violating Lebanon's airspace and using it to attack Syria and even launch its own attacks on Lebanon itself. So the Israelis certainly benefit from a weak Lebanon, but some of the Western powers who are against supporting Israel also seem to probably benefit from this, and they're trying to force Lebanon to bow to its wishes and exclude Hezbollah, which again, as the previous speaker indicated, is like one of the largest, if not the largest, party in Lebanon, and is really the strongest political group in the country. So it's part of the government, and we can't say, oh, they're terrorists. Actually, Hezbollah doesn't meet the definition of a terrorist country. They're defending their own country against the foreign occupier, and have a lot of support, even within the Christian community and the other communities that existed in Lebanon. And it's a very fractured country with many different divisions. But and of course, as I said, the demographics are still out of whack, because the Sunnis and the Shia are certainly larger than the Christian population, with the Shias probably being the number one group. But to break out of that rigid formula where you have to compete, get votes only from your own religious group, is, I think, a step that Lebanon's going to have to make at one point. But I agree with the previous speaker, the breakdown on nationalism issues and Palestinian issue and sovereignty would probably be very similar to what the current breakup of the Lebanese parliament is. But also there's egos involved, where people want to have a veto on the government, or they want to have control of the defense ministry, the finance ministry, whatever. There's a lot of that infighting going on, and as a result, they can't have any agreement. But Aoun's son-in-law is head of the Christian party, and there's a rivalry there between Hariri and Aoun that goes back to the Civil War. So they need to really almost have a clean slate, have new set of politicians that will not have the baggage that the other ones do.
Latham Arouf, let's turn our attention to the round after round of U.S. sanctions against Lebanon. These sanctions have been called an act of aggression against all of Lebanon. Why is the U.S. piling on the pressure when the nation is so obviously suffering?
Hoping to rally the population against the government and the political elites in Lebanon and create upheaval that either results in the expulsion of Hezbollah from government and or civil war. This is the formula done everywhere. This is the main reason for the use of sanctions as a weapon by the Western powers led by the United States. When we see that happening in Venezuela, we see that happening in Iran and Syria and North Korea and Cuba, any country that its people are on side with sovereignty will be sanctioned in order to starve that population to the point where they're willing to give in to imperialism and colonization just to be fed. So that's what's happening. And we can see that sanctions haven't worked in Iran, haven't worked in Syria, haven't worked in North Korea, in Cuba, half a century of that. And that's why we're at the stage where apartheid Israel fires four cruise missiles just off Beirut last night, and woke up my children's Christmas night, the Merry Christmas to our Christian viewers around the world, and threats of attacking Iran directly are being made by the United States with the deployment of nuclear submarines in the Gulf That's even one of the scariest threats that we've
Very
had
well.
Since the Cuban crisis, Cuban Missile Crisis.
All right, we're out of time. I'm sorry to interrupt you there. Allow me to thank my guests, the lawyer and political commentator Edward Corrigan, joining us on the line from London, Ontario. Also, thanks to activist and political commentator Mr. Laith Maruf, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also, special thanks to you all for staying with us on this debate.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أَفَلَمْ يَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَتَكُونَ لَهُمْ قُلُوبٌ يَعْقِلُونَ بِهَا أَوْ آذَانٌ يَسْمَعُونَ بِهَا فَإِنَّهَا لَا تَعْمَى الْأَبْصَارُ وَلَكِنْ تَعْمَى الْقُلُوبُ الَّتِي فِي الصُّدُورِ
So have they not traveled through the earth and have hearts by which to reason and ears by which to hear? For indeed, it is not eyes that are blinded, but blinded are the hearts which are within the breasts.
The 46th verse of this chapter starts saying, أَفَلَمْ يَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَتَكُونَ لَهُمْ قُلُوبٌ يَعْقِلُونَ بِهَا Have they not traveled in the land so that they should have hearts wherewith to understand the truth? أَوْ آذَانٌ يَسْمَعُونَ بِهَا Or ears wherein to hear? فَإِنَّهَا لَا تَعْمَى الْأَبْصَارُ وَلَكِنْ تَعْمَى الْقُلُوبُ الَّتِي فِي الصُّدُورِ For verily, blind are not the eyes, but blind are the hearts which are in the breasts. So the verse says, أَفَلَمْ يَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ Have they not traveled in the land? So The beginning part of the verse is somehow trying to tell us that the experimental and scientific voyages are some worthy things which lead to the way of development of knowledge. And as a result, we will be having kinds of hearts that will be able to understand. فَتَكُونَ لَهُمْ قُلُوبٌ يَعْقِلُونَ بِهَا. So if they had traveled, they would have understood the things with their hearts. The reason is that the land and periods and history exactly, they are all just like classes of learning. So those who do not take examples from them are worthy of being blamed. Worse than the blindness of the eyes is the blindness of the hearts. That's why the verse continues saying, أَوْ أَذَانٌ يَسْمَعُونَ بِهَا فَإِنَّهَا لَا تَعْمَى الْأَبْصَارُ وَلَكِنْ تَعْمَى الْقُلُوبُ. If they had traveled in the land, they would have had hearts wherewith to understand the truth or ears to hear the truth. But blind are not the eyes, but are the hearts that are in the breasts. And the reason is that those hearts do not obtain their insight by advice and admonition. So the verse says, blind are the hearts. So persistence in obstinacy and hostility against the truth naturally transforms man and takes him into a point where he can recognize the truth neither by his intellect nor by his eyes and his ears.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. The words in the previous verses were about the unjust, cruel people whom were punished divinely for their wrong actions, and their cities and dwellings were all destroyed. So in this verse, it is just like continuing the previous points. أَفَلَمْ يَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ. Have they not traveled in the land? It's not specifically talking about land, but it is talking about traveling throughout the history. And that's why, as an emphasis on this matter, the Quran says, أَفَلَمْ يَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ. Have they not traveled in the land? So the ruined castles of the tyrants and the destroyed houses of the oppressors, who were once living in the highest degree of power with their mute tongue, delivers thousands of points while they are silent. These ruins are some expressive and alive books which explain the history of these nations, the explanations about the consequences of their deeds, about their shameful evil programs, and finally about their painful chastisement and punishment that was sent down by the Almighty Allah.
These silent lands and the traces that are remained in the ruins may cast such an exciting mood in the man's mind that sometimes the study of one of them teaches man some amount of matter, as much as the study of a thick book, and regarding the repetition of history, which is the fundamental point and principle of man's lives, illustrates the future before him. Verily, the study of the works of the people of old makes the ears hearing and the eyes seeing, and it may be for this reason that by numerous verses of the Holy Quran, man has been commanded to travel in the world. Of course, this is not any kind of travel. It's not just a joyous sightseeing and without having any specific plans for understanding. This traveling must be godly and ethical. So whatever he sees, it will awake him, and he will take a lesson and advice from these points. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when fate begins?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Round the world with reporters.
The Palestinian Refugees Committee in the Gaza Strip organized a rally against the UN AIDS and Health Services reduction. Palestinian refugees who have impacted badly by this reduction participated in the demonstration, calling for the world body's attention to the dire condition in the impoverished enclave.
It's our right to get the UN's aid services. People here are living in a deteriorating condition amid the pandemic. People here can't afford living, and now, with the reduction of the UN aid services, their life is getting even worse.
Palestinians believe the reduction in aid services by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, is an attempt by the U.S. to liquidate the humanitarian organization. Earlier, the U.S. announced plans to withhold $65 million of aid to the UNRWA until further notice.
The UN aid services reduction will have dire consequences as it deprives the Palestinian refugees from their basic rights. The reduction comes amid a critical political time as Israel is stepping up its pressure on the Palestinians.
By reducing the refugees' aid, the UN is standing beside the Israeli occupation at the expense of Palestinians' rights. We are calling for our rights, and the UN should fulfill its commitments.
The demonstrators call on the international community to reverse the reduction decision by the UN and keep on supporting the Palestinian refugees who have lost their lands and were expelled since 1948.
The reduction policy aims at reducing the aid services step by step until Palestinians are completely deprived of their rights. The UNRWA was established to help and support Palestinian refugees. The reduction policies serve Israel's interests.
UNRWA was established to aid the 700,000 Palestinians who were expelled from their homes during the war surrounding Israeli occupation's establishment in 1948.
More than the half of the 2 million people in the Gaza Strip are dependent on support from UNRWA, and depriving them from the services they need will worsen the living conditions. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Some 12 million children are facing a nightmare in Yemen, where one child dies every 10 minutes from preventable disease and the lack of healthcare services due to the ongoing war and the blockade imposed by the Saudi coalition.
We are about to enter the 7th year since the start of the aggression against our country, which has greatly affected the humanitarian situation, especially for children, who are the most affected segment in all aspects of life, such as health, education, social, and other aspects. And they have lost all the rights guaranteed by international human rights law.
The numbers of affected children continue to grow each day. 2.1 million children are acutely malnourished and 358,000 severely malnourished, meaning that some children are already suffering under famine-like conditions. Meanwhile, Yemen's Ministry of Health held a press conference to shed more light on the dire conditions of children in the country.
What the children of Yemen suffer as a result of the Saudi aggression and blockade since March 2015 is a real humanitarian catastrophe by all international standards. More than 2,400,000 children are deprived of education, and more than 3 million children are homeless. Malnutrition, which is spreading among children, has been condemned by international organizations and is said to be the result of not getting enough food.
Saudi Arabia has committed countless atrocities against children in Yemen, where children are also targeted by airstrikes. The air attacks have killed thousands of children and left thousands more suffering from disabilities, not to mention travel restrictions on thousands of patients, including children who need to travel for treatment.
As the world is silently watching an entire people being deprived of the basics of life, Yemen has become the most dangerous place in the world for children to grow up, according to UNICEF. Abdulatif Al-Washari, Sana'a.
The Knesset, the Israeli parliament, dissolved itself and the unity cabinet collapsed, pushing the Israelis into yet another early election on 23rd of March that would be the fourth in 2 years. The Knesset dispersed after failing to meet the legal deadline for approving a budget for 2020. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of the conservative Likud party had refused to present a budget in violation of his coalition agreement with his main rival turned partner Benny Gantz of the centrist Blue and White party.
The dissolving of the Knesset was simply because of Netanyahu's unwillingness to give up the premiership. The very possible scenario is the return of another political impasse for Israel. So Netanyahu will not be able to form a coalition that's satisfying and acceptable for all parties. We may even witness a fifth election after the upcoming vote.
Experts, however, say the dissolving of the Knesset would have been more advantageous for Netanyahu. It's not only a deep distrust between Netanyahu and Gantz. Netanyahu was gambling on another election in the hope of forming a right-wing religious cabinet that would grant him some kind of immunity from prosecution. Netanyahu's corruption trial is scheduled to move into an intensive evidentiary stage in early 2021, requiring his regular presence in court. The current cabinet will remain in place in a caretaker capacity until after the election, and the formation of a new cabinet is a process that could take many months. However, the Israelis are convinced that there isn't any guarantee that the fourth election would finally end Israel's internal dogged stalemate. According to observers, Netanyahu has triggered early elections in an attempt to stay in power beyond his current term. However, they add that Netanyahu's fight for re-election is a difficult battle, mainly as his corruption trial is scheduled to resume with witness testimony next February. Mona Kandib, Occupy, Ramallah.
Every year ahead of Christmas, this street in downtown Tehran gets packed with Christian residents in the capital, a rush to buy last-minute items to celebrate the birth of Jesus. This year, however, the hustle and bustle is gone, as the coronavirus pandemic has emptied the streets and pushed people into their homes. Many families cannot celebrate the festive season together. But Christians here say this does not mean they should abandon the celebrations when they can do it online.
Happy New Year and Merry Christmas to all. This year we miss all the family gatherings, but it's all right. We can catch up with each other using video calls. I hope that in the new year, the pandemic will be gone.
Merry Christmas to all Iran and all the world. And in spite of that we have this pandemic time, I wish everybody will have very soon good times, and 2021 will be happy for every of us.
Nearly 120,000 Christians live in Iran. The majority of them are Armenians, who follow the Oriental Orthodox branch of Christianity. While they make up less than 1% of the Iranian population, they feel at home when it comes to Christmas.
Merry Christmas. It's good to see the Christmas atmosphere running deep here in Iran, where the majority are Muslims. We feel at home here.
Iran has for the past month been under nationwide lockdown to contain the resurging virus. This has curtailed religious ceremonies across the red zones in the country, and church rituals are no exception. While 2020 was not a happy year, Christians here say it taught humanity a great lesson to value even the shortest moments with their loved ones. Knowing this year's Christmas, Happy New Year is more than just a wish, and everyone is praying that in 2021, the coronavirus will be a thing of the past. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Karina was a working mom with a job in the tourism sector, decimated by the pandemic. With no savings to fall back on, and with her husband's delivery job earnings nowhere near enough for them to get by, they ended up in a position no one wants to find themselves.
I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was in a financial difficulty.
Karina's quest for help led her to Educare Family Support Service, one of many publicly funded companies helping families down on their luck in the age of COVID.
We have lots of different food items that will go in. The plan behind it was that we would be able to prepare hampers for families, who disadvantaged families who may not be able to afford to have a Christmas meal or Boxing Day meal. So we've ensured that we've provided a hamper with everything excluding the meat. At the moment, we're on about 270. Literally, that is 270 families.
270 of many more families facing food insecurity and hunger, exacerbated by the pandemic, a situation that's drawn in UNICEF for the first time in its 70-year history in this country.
In these unprecedented times, I would imagine that these families have become known to their professionals that they're engaging with and are now require additional support.
This cavernous space is the interior of an Anglican church in West London. In normal times, it would see worshippers kneeling in prayer. Today, it's dedicated to something more pressing, getting food into people's cupboards.
I've got quite emotional, actually, about, you know, just the thought that you're privileged and get to enjoy Christmas and then other people are going without, especially at the moment with these troubled times. So I thought if I can come and make just a little bit of difference.
These hampers are being stuffed with supplies to last families for a few days. People used to go to food banks to pick them up. Since the onset of COVID, the whole project of compassion has taken on a new dimension, deliveries.
These volunteer drivers will be dropping off food and presents at hundreds of households for the next 3 days. A drop in the bucket considering the number of families depending on these supplies. And some of those families have up to 6 children.
Most of these volunteers found out about this project on social media, Some of them have dedicated their only day off to being here.
To see the family smiles and the people who need the things is, you know, I can't explain what you feel. The smile of them faces just can give me the energy. They can make my day.
Some have brought their young ones along so they can see firsthand what their less fortunate peers are going through. Those with bigger vehicles have come as couples to help transport more of this humanitarian assistance to homes where kitchen cabinets are not restocked as often as they should.
It's nothing for me to offer a couple of hours. So we are also in a position where it could be me who needs this support.
This year has been very contrasting in the fact that there's some people just getting richer and richer and richer, and we're reaching rock bottom, really, in sense of community is getting destroyed, really.
If you're feeding a family of 4 to 6 people, that's going to last, 2 days. It will get them through till Christmas Eve, hopefully.
And we all think we're struggling. Karina has had to adapt to her new world, caring for her 3-year-old daughter in a small rented apartment with no garden while her husband works, and looking after her ailing father who lives on his own.
I know a lot of people are suffering during this difficult time. It's very challenging, but you have to be positive at all times. Seek for help. If you don't ask, you don't get it.
Karina is perhaps one of the tens of thousands of families, if not more, for whom survival depends on charitable donations. Saeed Bourizza, London.
Christmas Eve 2020, Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed off on an historic post-Brexit trade and security agreement with the European Union after an intense 24-hour negotiation period. A press conference expected early in the day finally came in the afternoon after lawyers and translators had crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion. A year, a comprehensive Canada-style free trade deal between the UK and the EU, a deal that will protect jobs across this country, a deal that will allow goods, UK goods and components to be sold without tariffs and without quotas in the EU market, a deal which will, if anything, allow our companies and our exporters to do even more business with our European friends.
A deal will mean Britain finally leaving the bloc's single market and customs union in a week, and freedom of movement will end. It also settles the future arrangements on a vast range of issues, from aviation and transport to civil nuclear cooperation and energy. The sticking point that took Brexit to the brink of no deal was access to British fishing waters, a contentious issue that prompted the UK to send Navy ships to the English Channel in case of clashes, and the level playing field, which is an important part of the EU single market, allowing for fair and open competition. The negotiations were very difficult, with lots at stake for many, and it was an agreement worth fighting for. Will allow us to avoid major disruptions to workers, businesses and travellers after January 1st. It will protect European interests, and this agreement is also, I believe, in the interests of the United Kingdom. It will lay solid foundations for a new start with long-time friends, and finally, it will ensure we can leave Brexit behind us. Europe continues to move forward. Despite the collective sighs of relief and resignation across Britain, the devil is in the detail. French media made waves in the hours leading up to it by asserting the UK had made huge concessions, something Westminster was quick to deny. Hardline Tory Brexiteers from the European Research Group have said its Star Chamber of Lawyers will be convened to analyse the proposed agreement, suggesting it's not over yet. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Pakistan had a fresh round of negotiations with the UAE in an effort to repair lingering strained relations between the two countries. Pakistan has been under pressure from the UAE to normalize ties with the apartheid state of Israel since August this year, when Abu Dhabi recognized Tel Aviv. For the first time, Islamabad publicly admitted about the existence of a lingering UAE demand to Pakistan to grant diplomatic recognition to Israel.
A UAE home?
Something which Islamabad rejected after country's foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi.
Maine unki khidmat mein Pakistan ka mauqif.
I have abundantly made it clear to the UAE that Pakistan under no circumstances can establish diplomatic ties with Israel until a permanent and durable solution is found to the Palestinian issue. I have told them about anti-Israeli public sentiments in Pakistan and reminded them of the similar nature of dispute between Kashmir and Palestine.
Foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi has followed suspension of visas to Pakistani citizens after alleged behind-the-scenes threats to Islamabad to replace its 1.5 million expatriates if Pakistan resisted pressure to normalize ties with Tel Aviv.
Pakistan made its position clear because of the mounting pressure from some of the Islamic countries. The problem for Pakistan is that at the public level, at the people level, it is very difficult to sell this idea of giving recognition to Israel, because for decades, Pakistani people have been steadfastly supporting the cause of the Palestinian people.
Despite close brother relations with the UAE, tens of thousands of people protested against Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with Tel Aviv. Israel has been desperate to normalize ties with Pakistan, hoping that if it happens, other Islamic countries would also follow the suit. However, observers say that Israel's effort through UAE and Saudi Arabia to create compelling conditions against Pakistan to normalize ties have fallen flat. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The United Nations Security Council has held a virtual meeting to review the 10th report into the implementation of Resolution 2231, which endorses the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. During the session on Tuesday, Iran's permanent representative to the UN slammed the United States for not only failing to honor its own obligations under the resolution, but also obstructing the implementation of the commitments by other signatories. Takra Banshi explained that in the past 4 years, the U.S. has imposed over 1,500 sanctions against Iran, targeting almost all sectors of Tehran's economy and cutting nearly all dividends from the nuclear agreement for Iran. He also referred to the humanitarian impacts of the sanctions on Iran, saying the embargoes are affecting the most vulnerable people in the country.
The United States claim that humanitarian goods are exempt from sanctions is an absolute lie. As an example, even today, we cannot easily import medicine for relieving the breathing problems of those injured by chemical weapons which were provided by some Western countries to Saddam and used by him during his aggression against Iran.
The Iranian ambassador reiterated Tehran's stance that any proposal for the revision, renegotiation, or extension of the JCPOA is against the UN Resolution 2231 and absolutely unacceptable.
Iran has paid a heavy price and has done much more than its fair share to preserve the JCPOA. Therefore, no one can expect us to do more.
Takra Banshi further said that the deal cannot be linked to anything outside of the nuclear program, such as Iran's missile capabilities.
To develop a conventional missile program is an inherent right of any country under international law, and Iran is no exception. Consequently, Iran will not negotiate its legitimate ballistic missile program.
The Security Council session came a day after the foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the JCPOA held a virtual meeting and reiterated their commitments to preserving the agreement. China and Russia in particular call on the U.S. to unconditionally return to the deal and lift its unilateral sanctions against Iran. This comes more than 3 weeks after the Iranian parliament passed a bill that requires the Iranian government to suspend more commitments under the nuclear deal in case sanctions continue. Iran started scaling back some of its commitments a year after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal. Tehran has time and again rejected any preconditions for reviving the agreement, noting that they will go back to full compliance once all the other parties to the court uphold their own end of the deal.
This is
For a Better Life.
For a Better Life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome once again to another program of For a Better Life. We're talking about arrogance, dear brothers and sisters, and we also talked about the reasons why we get arrogance, why this feeling come within us. And number one, it was property and wealth that could give us arrogance if we don't work on ourselves to be humble. And number two, it could be knowledge, especially for those who are students. That's knowledge could give us arrogance. I know something that you do not know. And number three, fame, celebrity, family connections. My father is this and that person. My brother is this and that person, and so on and so forth. All of these things could give us arrogance. And we also talked about the cure. One of the cures was, one of the remedies was to be humble. If you're humble and you practice some techniques, that might crush your ego, that might crush your feeling of arrogance. And it does not matter if you are the CEO of a billion-dollar corporation, if you are the manager of a bank, if you are a manager of a hospital. If you do these techniques, which brings humbleness, which crushes your arrogance, try to be humble. Another thing one can do is not to give orders. Because when one gives an order, it means usually that he or she thinks he is bigger than others. He is more important than others. You know, Ayatollah Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, his wife would say later on that Ayatollah Khomeini never gave us any orders. He would never give us any order. Bring me a glass of water. Bring me my shirt. Bring me my shoes. Do this and that. But he would say, it feels like the weather is cold today. It feels very chilly in the room. And by doing so, by saying it indirectly, we understood that maybe he wants a shirt, and we would go up and bring a shirt for him. You see, the respect and the adab, the ethics that Ayatollah Khomeini has when it comes to his own family. And there is nothing wrong, according to the Sharia, to give orders within your family. But again, you see that you have to see yourself as the most humble person. Or if you want anything, you could say please, thank you. Practice those words. Even if you give an order, you can say please. Ask for it in a nice manner. That will again stop your arrogance from growing. But the most ideal form, dear brothers and sisters, is that you do not give any orders at all and try to do it yourself. And for any reason, if you cannot, or it's more practical if that person in your family does it for you, you could ask very kindly, practice to talk very nicely to that person, and ask for that thing that you need. Some trustworthy people relate that the late Mirza Muhammad Taqi Shirazi, one of the scholars of the deen, would even refrain from giving orders not only to his followers, not only to people in the society, but even refrain from giving orders in his house. He would not order his wife to bring dinner or clear the dishes. He would go without dinner if his family forgot to give it to him. And that, again, is nothing wrong. It is not forbidden if you give orders in your family. But one must practice fighting against his nafs.